Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
As far as I know, I was never infected with COVID-19, and a few weeks ago, I received my second dose of the vaccine, which feels like a huge relief. I've been careful to follow public health recommendations, but the truth is my social and economic privilege may have been even more important. Privileges like private transportation, a safe place to live, a job that provides health benefits, heck, a job in an office and not on a crowded assembly line. All these things surely played an enormous role in keeping me and my family safe. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Public health experts know all about this, that vulnerability to COVID and to many other health problems overlaps really closely with other kinds of hardships. But as we'll hear, in many places, state and local health officials are actively discouraged from talking about the ways a more equitable society would be a healthier one. Science journalist Amy Maxman writes for the journal Nature, which published her article, Inequality's Deadly Toll. Amy, welcome to Think.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
You open with a story of a family that in some ways reflects both the American dream and an American nightmare. Hardeep Singh is a medical student pursuing a degree as well in public health. His mom, who is 63, does not speak English, and she works in a poultry plant in the San Joaquin Valley. What happened when Singh's mom tested positive for COVID?
So yeah, when she tested positive, you know, there were some signs that Foster Farms had already had a number of cases at the plant. And so they began to institute this, Foster Farms instituted a testing system so that on some rotating basis, all the workers were tested for COVID, just for surveillance purposes to see if there's an outbreak. And in order to, it's an automated system. So he signed up to get the alerts because she doesn't have a smartphone. She doesn't speak English. So he got the automated alert one day that she had tested positive. And so he tried calling her at work. She was at work that day. He tried calling over and over again. She didn't pick up, which I suppose makes sense because she was working. And then only at the end of the day, when he picked her up, you know, he picked her up at the factory and said, "Can you sit in the back seat?" He had the windows down. And he was the one who broke the news to her that she was positive. And then, you know, she had actually just been assigned shifts for the rest of the week. So not only was she not told about her own positive test, but she was assigned more shifts.
Can we assume that her supervisors did know, but just chose not to share that with her directly?
This is the part where I did go to Foster Farm, so I don't know. They sent me a statement saying that if people have complaints, they can go to their supervisor, but it was their system. So it was their testing system. So I'm not sure on what level it broke down, but he tried reaching the company for days to ask if she can stay home and get the COVID sick leave they had said that people could get if they test positive, but he couldn't reach anyone. So he had to keep her home. He heard he had to get a doctor's note. So he had to find a doctor who would write a note about this. And it was only on 6 days later that he did get a call from Foster Farms saying that she had tested positive, and that I think at that point she had something like 2 days left for her allotted time for isolation. So I should say at that plant, you know, by the end of the year, more than 400 employees had tested positive at that plant, just at this one Foster Farms plant. So, you know, this is probably one way that the infection was spreading. Because people were working next to each other in a place with poor ventilation all day long, and they may or may not have known if they were positive. And if they didn't have somebody like Hardeep Singh to say, you have to stay home, they might not have been able to do that.
What have studies shown about the extra deaths among food and agricultural workers just in California last year?
Well, in California, there were, let's see, I have the statistics. So there's a study showing that agricultural workers in California had a 40% increased risk of dying last year from COVID. That part's assumed because there was an excess death. And within the 40% increased risk of dying, there's other contrasts. So Latino food and agriculture workers had a 60% increase in deaths compared to white workers, who had a 16% increase in deaths. So there's a big disparity there in in really who's catching the disease.
Yeah, like four times the rate.
Yeah, it's pretty massive.
So why are agricultural workers at particular risk aside from the conditions of the jobs themselves?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So when I say agricultural workers, I'm thinking everything from meatpacking to farms to food processing plants. And the reasons are many. So one of them is, say, the wages are really low. This means that you might not, you know, opt to stay home when you are positive because you actually really need that day-to-day money to feed your family and to pay the rent. Another reason is that there's very few worker protections that are enforced. So people are working in close contact with each other, and there's not a lot of oversight of the companies that they work for. And another issue is if people are undocumented or if they're not, you know, full legal residents in the U.S., they're in a really precarious position. So, for example, if, you know, my company, I work for Nature. So if they, you know, said I had to go into the office and I felt the conditions were unsafe, I could seek legal counsel. I feel empowered enough that I could do that. But if I was worried about my, you know, position in the U.S. or if I felt like I was in a vulnerable spot, I might not seek any sort of legal help because I just, you know, need to make ends meet.
So undocumented folks have little or no access to unemployment funds, publicly funded social services, or government health benefits. But to be clear, undocumented people overwhelmingly do pay taxes on their wages, right?
Yeah, they do. It's taken out of their fee. It's taken out of their payment.
So the San Joaquin Valley, where you focus this story, is a really interesting place to center this reporting. It sounds like a place that is just rife with contradictions, right? Like rich land for growing crops, one of the highest poverty rates in the country. Many of the people who grow and pick our food there rely on nonprofits to keep their families fed.
Yeah, they do. There's food distribution events kind of on an ongoing basis that predates COVID.
So what other kinds of new work have grassroots groups taken up in the San Joaquin Valley since the start of the pandemic?
So this was sort of a slow going. So since the very beginning, these various grassroots groups that, you know, there's some that serve Latino workers, there's some that serves Indian workers. The various groups wanted to be a part of the COVID response. Their point was, you know, we know our communities best. We know their vulnerabilities. We know how to talk with people. We speak the right languages. They wanted to be involved. They were sort of shut out of the response, and it was a huge battle. I've watched all of these sort of town hall meetings online. But eventually in August, when COVID was, you know, surging in the San Joaquin Valley, when it was worse there than anywhere else, it was around 60% of all cases were in Hispanic people. The county and the city of Fresno gave these groups, some of these groups, money. They sort of banded together. There's around 20 of these community organizations. They banded together along with UCSF Fresno, which provided free testing. And they called themselves the COVID-19 Equity Project.
So they called themselves an equity project, but they weren't able to have enough reach to fix broad inequities like housing quality and job access.
Yeah, they weren't, you know, it wasn't, this was sort of a Band-Aid on a hemorrhaging wound. What they did do a lot of, you know, I think part of their mandate wasn't just to get people tested, but also to do kind of contact tracing. But what a lot of the community health workers I spoke with told me is that really, you know, people would be calling just sort of desperate because they, you know, couldn't afford rent, couldn't keep the lights on. There was a lot of, you know, grants being given out for things like just paying utilities, for hunger, for that sort of thing. So they were a hugely important stopgap measure. They also got money for sick leave. So that was another issue that for a long time, and it's still intermittent, so there would be a splash of funds and then it would go away. You know, a huge issue that I heard about a lot while I was reporting in the San Joaquin Valley is that people didn't want to get tested because if they were positive, there's nothing they could do about it. It would just be in their head. They absolutely needed money to go to work, and there was no guarantee of sick leave, meaning, you know, if they miss work, they can't make money. And I heard some stories of people even being fired if they tested positive because there were other workers to replace them with.
Wow. I can't imagine having to make that choice between going to work sick and having my family go hungry or be evicted because I didn't have any money.
Yeah. I mean, and I spoke with people who would still be in the throes of COVID and feeling really sick, but yeah, still go to work on a farm.
So I want to be clear, because we've been talking a lot lately on this show about the ways that structural inequality affects health outcomes. But this is by no means a new phenomenon to doctors or to social scientists, right?
Yeah. And that was sort of my other thought in going to report this whole story, was it was so unsurprising where we saw the disparities happen in the U.S., sort of whatever, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction to this piece, sort of like whatever infectious disease is going around, it almost always hits sort of low income people and marginalized people harder. That's sort of a trend that we see across so many diseases and that we have seen for, you know, I looked back in the literature for, you know, 150 years, this sort of discrepancy has been reported.
There's always something that sticks with me from every conversation I have. And I think this fact is it. In the United States now, the wealthiest 1% of men live on average 14 years longer than the poorest 1% of men. It feels criminal to me.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, and there's so much data on this. The fact is, income correlates really well with life expectancy. So inequality, we're also seeing growing disparities in terms of health.
How has the pandemic managed to make us look at this and pay attention to it in a way that decades of well-meaning advocacy failed to do, despite the fact that a lot of these problems already existed?
I guess it provides a very compressed example. Mm. You know, the fact that we can see such clear trends emerge within 1 year from one disease. So it doesn't get diluted out across so many diseases and over time.
All right, so let's talk about how public health departments have tried to address this. You learned that Fresno County's mostly white board of supervisors refused to do anything substantive about conditions at meat packing facilities. Why did they say those changes weren't necessary? And why were they reluctant to change conditions in agricultural fields?
Well, you know, there's various things that people were pushing for. So, for example, when it came to saying, okay, shouldn't we have it so that there's more testing at farms and at meatpacking plants? And so that when anybody, as soon as we know that somebody's positive, that they can go isolate and stay at home. Well, if you want to make that a rule, that means that somebody, and it could be the company or it could be the state, is going to have to provide some sort of stipend to the person you're now sending home. And they also have to be protected so that they're not going to be fired. For something like quarantine, that's even more dramatic. If your coworker, if the person you work beside, if the person you share a ride to work with tests positive, again, if you want them to stay home, somebody needs to provide them an income. You know, I talked with the former vice president of Taiwan, and he told me they didn't want to do broad lockdowns. So they would give people stipends to isolate if they were either infected or if they were a close contact of somebody who was infected. So it costs money to do this sort of thing. The other thing is, if fewer people are at work because they're either infected or because they have to quarantine, you slow down business. And that can be pretty terrible, I should say, in an area where the economy really is agriculture. You know, there's a time when you can harvest and there's a time when the harvest season is over. So the idea that at the peak of harvest, you might have fewer workers on site, that could be pretty disruptive to that company.
And I get that it is complicated, right? Because a lot of us, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, were worried about the food supply and distribution system. And I would imagine anything that knocked American confidence off in the ability to provide food to everyone would have been a crisis.
Yeah. I mean, the Trump administration, you know, passed an executive order saying that meatpacking plants, for example, essential businesses like that provide food have to keep going during the outbreak. And in fact, production went up for a while. In my piece, I named one example that's actually a very rare example, but I spoke with a public health officer in Merced, which is a county within the San Joaquin Valley. And they started hearing, you know, rumors from the community that a couple of people who were employees at one of the Foster Farms plants in Merced, that a couple of them had died of COVID. So, you know, just to get the information on how many cases were at that plant was difficult. So finally, Foster Farms gave them a list of all of the cases of employees at the plant. And as they were going through it, they realized that there were several other people who are listed as deceased from COVID from the plant. So this really shocked them. I mean, you know, we know that roughly, let's say 1% of people die of COVID. It's pretty dramatic to see 8 deaths at a plant. And I should say they didn't die at the plant. They got COVID and they died later. So he really wanted to test everyone at the plant, you know, shut it down just so they could clean everything, test everyone, and, you know, control the outbreak. It was a huge fight. And when they tried to close the plant, not only did they get pushed back from the leaders of Merced, but they also got a call from a Trump administration official who said the plants have to remain open. This is an executive order.
It has been a pretty terrible year overall for public health officials across the country. What did you learn about the numbers of them leaving their jobs?
I'm having trouble with recall, but there is a large number of public health officials who have left their jobs this past year. And that's sort of a important thing I want to talk about, because my piece sort of pushes hard at public health, saying, what are you doing? You know, just because public health, a big part of it is helping the most vulnerable. So I felt like, what is public health officials doing to actually change the status quo? But I want to call out that they were under huge pressure this year. They were harassed by the public. They had to often work under elected officials who were doing things and making orders that were contrary to their advice. So they had a really tough year. A lot of them have left. I've talked with people in the CDC who were really between a rock and a hard place.
I'm cheating because I have your piece in front of me. I think that number, by the way, is 181 across the country. I mean, that's a huge number.
Oh, yes, exactly. It is a huge number. And these are people who are dedicated to their work. So it's sad.
Why have they been discouraged from talking about other contributors to infection, not just, you know, virus particles and that sort of thing, but why have public health officials been, in many places, been discouraged from talking about how substandard housing and hunger and poverty contribute to infectious disease?
Yeah, so, you know, the interesting thing is a lot of, you know, reports might cite these things. Like, there's a lot of reports, public health reports from the CDC and other, you know, and from academic researchers who will say, okay, this uneven toll among, you know, Black and Hispanic people that could have to do with discrimination and low wages and crowded households and poor access to healthcare. What they don't say is make the next step and say, okay, therefore, those are the problems. The solution should be higher wages and access to healthcare and, you know, labor protections. They don't make that switch. And the reason is, those are really hot topics. So if they were already getting yelled at for things like, you know, having people wear masks, imagine if they said undocumented immigrants should have health care.
So people say basically stick to curing diseases and putting thermometers in people's mouths.
It's a lot less controversial.
Huh. Academics have also been advised not to talk about inequality in public health, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, those voices might be getting louder now. Because a lot of the researchers I spoke with, and I guess I want to note that a lot of them are from these communities, like Hardeep Singh. They're from these sort of communities where they're kind of getting tired of the idea of, you know, not being political, just, you know, just try and stay out of the super controversial areas and do what good you can, which isn't wrong, by the way, you know. Make sure that people get their vaccinations. That's a less controversial area. So they'll study, they'll do a lot of studies on this. They'll do a lot of studies saying, you know, farm workers are hit much harder by COVID, or, you know, low wage healthcare workers are hit much harder by COVID. So they will study these things, but they're often dissuaded from getting political about it.
So another challenge for public health officials is building trust with the communities they serve. And you write about something that I hadn't heard much documented before, which is that in their role, part of which is sort of categorizing and understanding the rates of disease and illness, sometimes public health officials go around and ask a lot of questions about how people are, what their health problems are. It stands to reason that people will assume that that will be followed up by services or care. Public health departments don't always have the resources to follow up in that way.
Yeah, and then, you know, and even more so with academics. So academic researchers who are in public health schools have a ton of papers and reports about, you know, health disparities and why health disparities exist. So to do those reports, they do a lot of surveys. But they don't come back with solutions because the solutions are quite hard. And they feel like that's kind of not in their lane. But it can lead to frustration from those communities when they feel like, you know, public health researchers are really interested in what they're going through, but then it doesn't lead to anything.
So, Amy, if you or I felt unsafe at work, we have the option of going to OSHA and filing a complaint. How often does that happen among agricultural workers, and what comes of those claims? If you don't have how often, I'm just curious.
Looking at the numbers. Let's see. Oh, yes. So, right. So there were a ton of complaints to OSHA last year. I wrote down the site I wanted to look up in my story. So 13,000 complaints, more than 13,000 were made to OSHA last year, specifically about coronavirus related hazards. Really very few were followed up with inspections and even fewer with fines. I actually just read that Cal OSHA is going to fine Foster Farms, that Livingston plant in Merced, $130,000 for reporting COVID deaths too late and a couple of other things. That's really a drop in the bucket. I mean, compared to the profits made there, the Foster Farms family is within like the top 200 richest families in the U.S. They're small fines and they're also extremely rare. And then also this is after the fact. And one issue is OSHA is underfunded. And I think, you know, there's fewer and fewer inspectors at OSHA. It's declined over the years. So it's not really surprising that they were unable to inspect all of these different complaints. I spoke with somebody named David Michaels, who was the director of OSHA under President Obama. And he's been really upset to see kind of how the backbone has been ripped out of this agency. And I guess I could say one thing he told me was that the way we're structuring our economy is that so many workers have so few rights and they're so underpaid and they face hazards that would be unacceptable to the corporate leaders who profit from their work.
Amy, how segregated is the city of Fresno by race?
Pretty segregated. And that goes back, it dates back for almost 100 years now. And, you know, for this piece, I looked at maps of redlining within the city of Fresno. And these were sort of the maps that were used by home loan associations to figure out who gets access to loans and who doesn't get access to loans in order to purchase their houses. And it resulted in massive segregation. So in sort of southwest and southeast of Fresno, that was a lot of the areas that were redlined, meaning that they were not allowed access to loans. And this was because there was a lot of non-white populations there. And ever since then, the city sort of split up like that. You know, there's some crossover, of course, but it's a pretty segregated city, and sort of businesses and, you know, benefits like better schools and better grocery stores tend to be found in the northern areas of Fresno. And outside of Fresno, the city, it's within the San Joaquin Valley. There's all sorts of other towns that are built on top of really temporary tracts that were built for migrant workers, you know, as early as the 30s. This is something that John Steinbeck wrote about. And these tracks weren't even connected to, say, plumbing back then. And even now today, some houses don't have running water. They don't have clean water. And a lot of these sort of the sort of distribution of neighborhoods remains really similar to how it was back then.
So there are already resource inequities. That also means that the people with money and power might be able to escape even witnessing the kind of suffering that's happening in other neighborhoods that would make them care about this stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, what's the incentive to, say, improve the school system if it's not where your kids are going to school?
How concerned are health advocates that COVID will have the lasting effect of further widening inequality in this country?
Well, they're very concerned. I think there's a lot of data showing that the people who were hit worst economically are the lowest income quarter in the U.S. So, you know, there's various numbers on this, but there were, high-wage workers gained nearly 1 million jobs during the pandemic, whereas there was massive losses, millions of jobs lost among people who are in the lowest income quarter.
Do President Biden's economic stimulus proposals seem likely to have a measurable effect on the lives of essential workers who grow and harvest and process our food?
It depends on how much, you know, is adopted and moves forward. The kind of, you know, this year's plan, I think, definitely is in the right direction as far as that goes, because, you know, there's money for childcare. There's a push there for higher wages. So if that gets enacted, I think it really would help. And I've heard people say if it gets enacted, this is going to reverse our 40-year trend of rising inequality. You know, something like if people were paid a living wage, and this is what a lot of farm workers told me, if they just had a higher wage, if they weren't, you know, waiting in long lines for food distribution after they, you know, work on food all day, then they'd have a savings. So then even then, that would be a little bit more empowering. So you could say, hey, it's dangerous, I'm not going to work.
When you talk to, you know, people who are fairly privileged, lots of people have anxieties about COVID. There are people who think it's not such a big deal. I'm curious to know, Amy, when you were talking to folks who are working for low wages in agricultural and food processing work, how worried were they? Are they as aware as everybody else of the potential dangers of COVID?
That actually surprised me. And the answer is most people I talk to, yes. I think before I went to Fresno or into San Joaquin Valley, I had heard people say, you know, they don't believe in COVID or they don't care about COVID. But I would say overwhelming majority, I'd put it around 90% of all of the people I spoke to on a couple of trips I made, were really worried about COVID. But they were also really worried about paying the rent and really worried about paying for their kids' food. And so they were stuck between these two very difficult areas.
These are folks who are not given a lot of power or respect in our society. But I wonder if they share the sense of outrage that I think you and I are feeling right now, that they haven't been taken care of.
Yeah, they do. And they have, you know, we don't play clips on the show, but I record a lot of interviews that I listened to over and over again. And yeah, people are really upset. And they thought about this word essential worker a lot too, you know, knowing, you know, they're essential to our society functioning, but they're not treated, but their lives aren't necessarily essential. Their work is essential. So it was sort of the sort of anger to feel like they're feeding the people who don't really care about them.
And what sort of, did you see any organization, we've talked about grassroots groups, did you see organization on the part of workers themselves?
No, I talked to the advocacy groups, but not on the part of workers themselves. I mean, the people I spoke with, which, you know, and there's many, let me just say, you know, farm workers are far from the only essential worker that was in this position. I happen to, you know, write a lot about agriculture workers because that's what's in the San Joaquin Valley. But the people I spoke to were vulnerable. They were afraid to use their names a lot of the time. You know, they are terrified of often being deported, and other abuse, and they just sort of want to do their work and, you know, live their lives.
Just so everyone understands, your reporting was mostly from the San Joaquin Valley, but there's no reason that we can't extrapolate the basic premise of this piece to agriculture areas, I guess, in almost every part of the country, right?
Yeah, I think so. And although undocumented may not be the issue, there's lots of healthcare workers are, I think it's one of the fastest growing low wage working jobs right now is within healthcare.
So to Randy's question earlier, if we as consumers, people who have to buy food every week just to keep ourselves alive, want to know that the products we buy are not made available at the expense of the health of the people who produced it, is there any way to do that?
It's so hard. I mean, if you're a really good person, you can, really look into farms that go out of their way to say they're paying a good wage or that they're, organic as I, often preferred because people don't have to be in the pesticides when they're farming it. But it's really hard, and I can tell you that this story really upset me, and I don't do that,
It's
If I
also,
knew,
yeah.
to Randy's point, if I knew, I think that's a wonderful point. If I knew that, this store or this company pays more money and offers living wages, then I would opt to buy there.
But one thing that I've learned is that just because something costs more or says organic doesn't, aside from the pesticide issue, doesn't necessarily mean that it's fair trade or that workers are being treated well.
Exactly. It's so hard to know.
How do you process, working for weeks and months on a piece like this, your sense that you have some power in telling this story, but you don't have the power to sort of single-handedly make things better for the subjects that you report on?
Yeah, I think it's tough, and this isn't the first story that I've felt this way about. But if I just try and tell myself, we can only do the things that we feel like we, for whatever reason, are good at doing, and I feel like journalism is something I can do. So if anything, if it gets people at least talking about this, so going further than saying, poor people or marginalized people were really hit hard by COVID, if this gets people to dig deeper and say, why are people poor? What is it about our society that is allowing people to be exploited? And how do we change that? If it gets people to ask those questions, maybe some of the people who are asking the questions can go further than I can.
Science journalist Amy Maxman writes for the journal Nature, which published her article, Inequality's Deadly Toll. Amy, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.